You know that feeling, right? That very specific sinking feeling when you're staring at an automation test suite.
Oh, I know exactly where this is going.
Right. So you realize you have to test the exact same e-commerce checkout flow on Chrome and then on Firefox and then on Safari. And your brain just automatically goes, well, time to hit copy and paste.
It's just instinct at that point.
Yeah, you do it, but you just know deep down in your soul that you are creating an absolute maintenance nightmare for yourself.
Oh, 100%. It's a real affliction in the QA world.
Because, like, a month from now, a developer is going to change the ID of the checkout button, and you're going to be updating 100 different files. It's the ultimate developer headache, copy-paste fatigue.
Yeah, you start with one elegant, like perfectly crafted test, and suddenly you have 100 slightly mutated clones of it scattered across your entire directory
That's
structure.
exactly.
You end up spending way more time managing the boilerplate code than you do actually testing the application's logic.
But for you listening today, we are going to cure that fatigue. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Today's mission is solving that exact architecture problem using a really comprehensive guide we've got in front of us on Playwright projects. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Because when I first heard the term Playwright projects, I assumed, it meant a whole new Git repository.
A lot of people do.
Right. I pictured opening up a completely separate code base for every browser or every environment.
Which is honestly the single most common misconception developers have when they first read the documentation.
Really?
Oh, yeah. A Playwright project is not a separate code base. It is not a new folder full of test scripts.
Okay.
It is simply a named configuration that lives inside one file, your playwright.config.xs file.
Wait, just one file.
Just one. It's literally just an array of the project's array in that file, and it allows one single master test suite to run in dozens of different scenarios.
So by the end of this deep dive, you'll understand how to turn a single automation test into this scalable multi-environment powerhouse. And you're saying we do this without duplicating a single line of test code.
Not one line. You write the logic once, and the configuration handles everything else.
That is wild. Okay, let's start by clearing up the basic vocabulary then, because the source material points out that people constantly confuse Playwright test with Playwright projects.
Yes, very common trap.
So I want to try an analogy here to see if I've got the mental model right for this.
Go for it.
If we think about a high-performance car, Playwright test is the physical engine. Like, it's the framework, the runner, the raw horsepower that is actually doing the work of executing the code.
Right, it's the underlying infrastructure, turning the wheels, firing up the browser binaries, physically clicking the elements on the page.
But the Playwright project, that's the driving mode.
Ah, okay, I see where you're going.
Yeah, so you push a button on the console for sport mode or eco mode or snow mode. The physical engine hasn't changed, right? You didn't
No.
rebuild the car.
Right.
But the parameters for how the car behaves on the road,
Huh.
the suspension stiffness, the throttle response, those have shifted completely.
That's a great way to look at it. To take that metaphor a step further, the Playwright project is essentially the engine control unit, the ECU.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it intercepts the computer and says, hey, change the fuel injection rate for this specific terrain. It overrides the baseline behavior.
Got it.
Because in the old days of automation, if you wanted to test different terrains, you literally had to build a different car for each one.
So painful.
You'd maintain a chrome.config.ats, a firefox.config, maybe a mobile.config.
Or you just copy the test script 100 times, like we were saying
Yeah.
earlier, the whole copy-paste fatigue thing.
Exactly. But by leveraging that project's array in a single configuration file, the math of your testing infrastructure completely changes.
How so?
Well, if you write 100 tests and you define three projects in your config, say Chromium, Firefox, and Safari Playwright, executes those 100 tests across all three projects automatically.
So you get 300 test runs.
Yes, but you only maintain 100 tests. The logic stays identical, only the environment context changes.
Okay, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure.
Because the guide says I can just go into the command line, type npx playwright test dash dash project equals Chromium, and I'm supposed to believe it just magically knows what to do.
It does.
But what about all the specific browser settings, the viewport sizes, the user agents? How does the sport mode actually communicate with the engine to change those parameters on the fly?
So the mechanism doing all the heavy lifting there is called the use section.
The use section.
Right. Inside your Playwright config, each project you define has its own specific use block. Playwright operates on this cascade of configurations.
Cascade meaning like top down.
Exactly. You have your global shared configurations at the top of the file, things like, say, a global 30-second timeout setting,
okay,
or telling it to always take a screenshot on failure. But the project level use block merges with and overrides those global settings for that specific run.
I get it.
So for the Chromium project, the use block explicitly dictates browser name Chromium. When you pass that flag in the command line, the runner grabs that local override, injects it into the worker process, and boots up that specific browser binary.
Okay, so it's localizing the configuration into a specific container, basically.
Exactly.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Because the guide makes it very clear that projects aren't just for Chrome or Firefox.
Not at all.
Browsers are just the absolute tip of the iceberg when it comes to this use block.
Yeah, browsers are how everyone initially learns Playwright projects. It's like the hello world of configuration.
Right.
But it's just one tiny variable you can manipulate.
So for instance, the guide points out we can use predefined device profiles. So inside that use block, instead of just dropping in a generic browser name, I can drop in devices Pixel 5 or devices iPhone 13.
And instantly, your single test suite is executing true mobile responsive testing.
Just from that one string.
Yeah. And it's not just resizing the browser window to look like a phone. Under the hood, Playwright is actually pulling in the exact user agent string for an iPhone 13.
Oh, wow.
It's enabling touch events, so your click commands translate to mobile taps. It's setting the device scale factor, so retina displays render correctly. All of that is abstracted away into that single device profile string.
That is incredibly powerful. And we can push this even further into completely different environments, right? Like testing a local host versus a staging environment versus production.
Yes. This is where enterprise teams really start to extract massive value from projects.
How do they set that up?
Well, you can define a staging project and a production project. The test script is identical, say, a critical login and checkout flow.
Right.
But in the use block for staging, you set the base URL to your staging server's AP. For production, you just swap the base URL to point to your public live site.
Wait, hold up. If I set my production project to be a strict monitor of my live site, I definitely don't want my automation bot going rogue and creating 500 fake accounts with dummy credit cards in my production database.
No, you definitely do not.
So how do I stop the production project from running my destructive account creation tests?
So that is handled through test grouping parameters within the project configuration. Specifically, these properties called test match and test ignore.
Okay, I love this concept. Think of the Playwright project as a very strict VIP bouncer standing outside a nightclub.
A bouncer? Okay, I like that.
Yeah, and the bouncer has a clipboard with a highly specific guest list.
A bouncer that essentially clones the nightclub for different crowds.
Right. So if you set test match to look only for smoke.spec.eats files, that bouncer is only letting the critical non-destructive smoke tests pass the velvet rope into the production project club.
Exactly. Every other deep regression test or data mutating test gets turned away at the door.
It just ignores them completely.
Yep. And conversely, if you have a massive regression project running on staging, you can use test ignore to keep those smoke tests out.
Oh, because you already ran them.
Right. You aren't redundantly running them and wasting compute time if they already passed in a previous job.
It gives you surgical precision over what runs, where it runs, and under what conditions.
It really does. And you can tune the environmental behaviors, too. Like, in your staging project, you might set the retries configuration to 2.
Because staging servers are terrible.
Exactly. Staging environments are notorious for unoptimized database queries that cause random 504 gateway timeouts. A retry saves the test run from failing over a temporary environment micro outage.
That makes sense.
But in your production project, you set retries to 0.
Oh, I see. Because you want to know immediately.
Right. If production goes down for even a millisecond, you need the pipeline to fail and page an engineer instantly. You do not want the framework silently hiding a production failure behind a retry.
That precision becomes even more critical when we shift from the environments to the actual humans using the app.
Yes.
Because apps aren't just used by different browsers, they're used by different user personas.
Let's consider testing a complex SaaS platform. You have an admin role with full dashboard access.
Okay.
A manager who can only see specific reports, a customer, and a logged out guest.
That's a lot of roles to test.
In traditional automation, testing these 4 personas meant writing 4 separate setup routines.
Ugh, the boilerplate.
Right. every single test had to manually open the page, type in the admin username, type in the password, click login, and wait for the dashboard to render before the actual testing could even begin.
Over and over again, just burning seconds on every single test, navigating the login UI.
Which bloats your execution time exponentially. But with Playwright Projects, you handle this at the configuration level using the storage state property inside the use block.
Okay, wait. If I'm not physically having the bot type in the password for the admin, how does the application know I'm the admin? Is Playwright just caching the session locally somehow?
It's much more sophisticated than a cache. Playwright allows you to perform the login sequence exactly once.
Just once.
Just once. And then it saves the entire browser context, all the secure cookies, the session storage, the local storage tokens, into a raw JSON file.
Like an admin.json file.
Exactly. Let's call it admin.json. When you configure your admin project, you point the storage state property to that specific JSON file.
Wow.
So when the test runner boots up a new browser context for the admin project, it takes that JSON payload and directly injects it into the browser's memory before the page even attempts to load.
Meaning it fundamentally bypasses the network requests and the UI rendering of a login flow.
Precisely.
So test script starts, and boom, you are already sitting on the authenticated dashboard. Zero friction. No typing passwords. No waiting for the login servers to respond.
You got it. And you can create a separate project for the customer persona, pointing to customer.json.
This is so clean.
It gets better. You can layer these configurations. Say your business is expanding into Europe and you need to test internationalization.
Like different languages and currencies.
Right. You can create a project that uses the customer storage state, but you also add a property setting the locale to DDE for Germany, and maybe even set a specific European time zone.
So now your exact same test logic is verifying that the dates, currencies, and numbers all format correctly for a German customer who is already authenticated without writing a single line of new test code.
The power of that matrix is incredible.
It really is.
But, and there is a big, but here it also introduces a massive risk.
Data conflicts.
Yes.
Because if I'm running these projects in parallel, say, an admin project and a customer project, they're hitting the database at the exact same time.
This raises an important question, and it actually brings us to mistake number 4, highlighted in the source material, ignoring test data conflicts.
You know that feeling when you wake up at 3 a.m. to an alert that your CI pipeline failed?
The worst feeling?
You spend 3 hours pulling your hair out debugging the application, only to realize the app is perfectly fine.
It's always the tests.
Exactly. The failure happened because your Chromium project was trying to update a user profile while your WebKit project, running the exact same millisecond, deleted that exact same user profile.
It is absolute chaos. You will get false negatives that just destroy your team's trust in the automation suite.
Yeah, because the framework tells you a test failed, but it wasn't a bug in the application. It was a race condition in your test data.
Which is why the guide emphasizes the absolute necessity of isolated test data. If you are going to unleash the power of parallel projects, every project or even every individual test file needs its own unique data entities to operate on.
You cannot have the German customer project mutating the same database rows as the mobile Safari project.
Exactly.
So if I have isolated data and I'm running an admin project, a German customer project, and a mobile Safari project, how do I actually prime the database for all of these specific scenarios before the tests explode? Like, how do we orchestrate this?
That's where orchestration features like dependencies come into play.
Dependencies, all right.
You can configure a project within the array so that it literally cannot start its execution until another specified project finishes successfully.
So you can daisy chain them. Project B is blocked until Project A gives the green light.
Precisely. You create a foundational project called Setup. Its only job is to execute API calls to seed the database with isolated test users and then generate those authentication JSON files we just discussed.
Oh, I see.
Then in your other projects, the ones actually running the end-to-end UI tests, you add a simple line that says dependencies array setup.
So the e-commerce checkout test won't even attempt to boot up a browser until the database is fully primed and the authentication states are perfectly constructed.
Exactly. And it works in reverse, too. Playwright supports teardown projects, which run after all your dependent projects finish.
I'll have to clean up.
Right. The teardown project executes raw SQL queries or hits a backend API to nuke the test users, ensuring your database doesn't bloat with gigabytes of garbage data over time.
I love how this orchestration maps so perfectly to CI/CD pipeline strategies like using a GitHub Actions matrix.
It's a perfect match.
Because you definitely don't want to run this massive, dependent, multi-browser, multi-locale setup and teardown matrix every single time a developer pushes, like a one-line CSS fix to a pull request.
Doing so would completely bottleneck your engineering velocity.
Right. The strategy outlined in the guide is incredibly clean. A developer opens a pull request. The GitHub action triggers a specific command, npx playwright test dash dash project equals smoke.
Keeping it lean.
Yeah, it just runs that ultra-fast Chromium-only smoke project. The developer gets feedback in 2 minutes.
Beautiful.
But then, for the nightly build, when the servers are quiet and everyone is asleep, that's when the CI triggers the massive regression projects across Chromium, Firefox, WebKit, and mobile profiles for that full matrix coverage.
It's all about balancing the fast feedback loop that developers require during the workday with the comprehensive risk mitigation the business requires before a release.
But let me push back on that architecture for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Playwright is famously fast.
Yeah.
It's lightweight. And these projects can run completely independently in parallel using worker processes.
Sure.
So if it's so fast and highly parallelized, why not just run the entire full suite on every single pull request and get it over with? Why bother splitting it up?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about the raw execution speed of the Playwright runner on a GitHub Actions container. It's about the infrastructure supporting the application under test.
Ah, the application servers themselves.
Exactly. Excessive parallel execution is essentially a self-inflicted denial of service attack. If you spin up 50 Playwright workers running tests across 10 different projects simultaneously on every single pull request that is 500 concurrent, highly aggressive connections, slamming your staging environment all at once.
The infrastructure just melts down.
Completely. You'll crash the staging database with concurrent write locks. You'll instantly hit API throttling limits on third-party integrations like Stripe or PayPal payment gateways.
Because they think they're under attack.
Yes. The source material explicitly warns about this. You have to monitor and scale your parallel execution to match your back-end limits. Just because the testing framework can create a dozen projects and execute them all simultaneously doesn't mean your staging infrastructure can survive the load.
Right, so you're basically DDoSing your own app with your QA suite and then wondering why the tests are timing out.
It's a very common trap for teams migrating to Playwright from slower, older frameworks. They get drunk on the speed and forget the laws of physics regarding their servers.
That makes total sense. Before we wrap up, I want to make sure you out there listening are equipped with a few more warning signs of a poorly configured framework.
Good idea.
We need to talk about pitfalls. But real quick, I have to give a shout out to the visual debugging tools Playwright offers. The guide mentions UI mode, which you get by running with the dash dash E flag in your terminal, and the VS Code extension.
The visual tooling fundamentally changes how developers interact with tests.
It really does. Instead of memorizing 50 different command line flags to run specific configurations, you get this beautiful sidebar where you can just click a checkbox next to a project name.
So much easier.
Yeah. If a test fails only in the WebKit project, you just check the WebKit box, run it visually, and watch exactly what's failing. It gives you time travel debugging, network interception visibility, and lets you see the DOM snapshot at the exact millisecond of the failure without all the noise of the other browsers.
It pulls all the abstraction away and lets you see exactly what the runner is seeing. But even with incredible visibility tools, there are architectural traps you can fall into.
Like what?
Well, mistake number 5 in the guide is one every engineer needs to hear: the flaky test trap.
Oh boy. We talked earlier about setting retries to 2 for a staging environment because staging servers can drop connections.
Right.
But there's a massive difference between handling external environmental instability and using retries as a band-aid to hide a fundamentally flaky test.
It is a critical distinction. If a test fails randomly, say, 1 out of every 5 runs, and you just bump the project retries up to 5 just to force that green check mark in your CI pipeline, you are deliberately ignoring the root cause of a bug.
You're just masking it.
Completely. You might have a race condition in your front-end React components where the state update is trailing behind the DOM manipulation,
okay,
or an internal API that is legitimately timing out 10% of the time. If you use project-level retries to brute force a passing grade, those bugs will absolutely make it to production and impact real users.
It's like turning up the radio in your car to ignore the weird grinding sound your engine is making.
That's a perfect analogy.
It doesn't fix the engine, it just makes you feel better until the car explodes on the highway.
Exactly. The framework is trying to tell you something is wrong. Listen to it.
I also have to laugh at mistake number three, which is naming conventions. The guide practically pleads with us not to name projects Project 1 or Test 1, 2, 3.
Oh, please don't do that. Because when that project fails in your CI logs at 2 a.m., a Slack alert that says Project 1 failed tells the on-call engineer absolutely nothing about the context of the failure.
Right. Best practice number 4 says use highly descriptive names like mobile Chrome smoke, production regression, you customer off.
Names that actually make sense to the whole team when they read the dashboard.
Exactly. So what does this all mean? When we look at all these features, the environments, the personas, the common mistakes, what is the golden rule for architecting playwright projects?
The golden rule is really about balance, inheritance, and purpose. Keep your common configurations global. Do not repeat timeouts or reporter settings in every single project block. Use project-specific settings only where they are strictly needed to override the global baseline.
Makes sense.
And above all, ensure every single project has a clear, distinct purpose. If you can't articulate exactly why a project exists in your array and what unique risk it is mitigating, it shouldn't be there.
So to synthesize this whole journey, playwright projects are the ultimate architectural cure for duplicated code.
Absolutely.
They allow you to write one master test suite, one beautifully crafted set of business logic, and project it across an infinite matrix of variables, browsers, mobile devices, authenticated user roles, global locales, staging, production.
It's all just different driving modes for the exact same powerful engine.
It is a fundamental shift in how we architect automation.
Mm-hmm.
It separates the what we are testing from the where we are testing it.
It really is, and it actually leaves me with a thought to ponder about where this industry is heading.
Oh, lay it on us.
We've just seen how playwright projects allow our code to perfectly adapt to every digital variable, browsers, roles, locales, devices, without us having to rewrite a single line of logic.
Because the configuration is entirely decoupled.
Precisely. So if the configuration matrix is completely decoupled from the test logic, are we rapidly approaching a future where a QA engineer simply defines the business rules and an AI writes one universal master test?
Oh, wow.
Like the AI understands the core logic, and then the framework automatically maps out, generates the projects, and explores the entire known digital universe for us. The test engine builds itself, and the projects dynamically adapt to test every possible user scenario.
Hold on. So the QA engineer just becomes a prompter who feeds the AI the business requirements,
mm-hmm.
and the AI builds this massive self-orchestrating matrix.
It's entirely possible.
Are we automating ourselves out of a job here, or just automating away the boring boilerplate parts?
That's the real question.
That is slightly terrifying, but also an incredible thing to chew on next time you open up your config file. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep applying what you've learned, and always keep questioning your frameworks. We'll see you next time.